This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. No one wants child molesters on their block, in their neighborhood, in their town. There's no certainty to determine which sexual predators can be taught to control their behavior and which ones can't. So, in recognition of their continuing threat, the Supreme Court agreed in 1996 that convicted child molesters can continue to be held even after their sentences are completed, but only as long as they're receiving treatment. Even so, the idea of holding men, and the overwhelming majority of them are men, after they've served their time is disturbing. The state of California established a post-prison treatment program for convicted sexual predators, and this week its first graduate will move into a trailer on the grounds of Soledad Prison south of San Francisco. Brian DeVries is a serial child molester. He sexually assaulted 9 young boys. To monitor his activities, the state will spend $180,000 a year on technology to track his every move. He will also continue his intensive therapy. DeVries' arrival in Soledad is raising tempers and questions about community safety, rehabilitation, and the allocation of community resources. So, where are convicted child molesters who have done their time supposed to go? You may not want them in your community, but they have to go somewhere. If you have questions about sexually predatory behavior or ideas about what we should do with released child molesters, give us a call or send us an email. The phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. San Francisco Chronicle reporter Alan Gathright has been covering the DeVries case. He joins us now from his office in San Jose, California. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
It's a pleasure to be here.
DeVries was supposed to be released initially into his father's custody in Washington State. What happened with that?
Well, they've actually sought lots of places for him to live. Initially in May, he was supposed to live in a hotel in San Jose, California. That's because that's where inmates are typically released to the county where they were last convicted. But the press reports got out, and there was an uproar. And so state authorities couldn't find a place for him to live in Santa Clara County. And so they said, well, let's send him to live with his father in Washington State. And Washington said, state officials, including their governor, said, like hell. And the governor up there said, we're going to do everything in our power to make sure he doesn't set one foot in this state. And finally, California officials agreed that part of the problem was, would a California judge be able to enforce the terms and conditions that Mr. DeVries has agreed to outside of California? And both the attorney generals in California and Washington State said no. I mean, there would be no recourse. They would have no legal jurisdiction to enforce those rules once he was, left California.
So why Soledad?
I think folks in Soledad feel that, they finally became, it's a very small city that includes, it's like 13,000 people. It's largely a farming community with 2 large state prisons there. And I think they feel like we were the after looking at more than 100 homes and, residents, private residents in the Santa Clara County area, in the South Bay area, that they were the folks with the least power. I think one reason the state went there is because they had state property there. They had a prison, and he is living in a white trailer 100 feet from Interstate Highway 101, outside the walls of the prison. So he's living like he's in a fishbowl, basically.
I've read that trailer, though, is pretty close to an encampment of seasonal workers and their children.
Absolutely. It's less than a quarter of a mile, some people say about 200 yards, from a camp that has about 100 families, lots of kids that are, supervised by their older siblings or babysitters or and running free in this camp during the day while their parents are at work. So there's lots of concern about that. The only thing that separates the camp from this kind of unsecured grounds of the prison are 2 10-foot high cyclone fences without any barbed wire on top of it, that sort of thing.
So is the community alarmed?
The community is there are recent voices, but the story, the comments you frequently hear is, this guy's leaving here one way or the other. They can either throw him out or carry him out. So there's lots of threats that, someone will take care of him. And since his trailer is clearly visible, I mean, you could throw a rock at it from the freeway, there are fears that someone might try to harm Mr. DeVries.
Well, what made him a candidate for release, the first graduate of this treatment program?
You know, I was talking to a top prosecutor in the state that deals with sex offense crimes, and she goes, you know, if anyone has demonstrated the commitment to change, this guy has. And he's been in this program since he was released from prison in 1997. He is a man who has been convicted of molesting 9 boys in 3 states and has confessed to molesting a total of 50 boys. So he has quite a history. But first he volunteered. He was very dedicated to his treatment during the civil commitment program. And first he went through chemical castration. He took things for that. And then he voluntarily, in 2001, went through surgical castration. And experts, psychiatrists at the prison said, you know, when this guy petitioned for release, as they are allowed to, after they're committed in 2-year segments, so after 2 years they can see if they can be released. Several experts, I think, unanimously said, you know, we think this guy could be released unconditionally in the community. He said, no, impose conditions on me, watch me. I want people to feel comfortable. So he's kind of considered like he's gone, like, you know, very far on showing his commitment on this issue.
Yet the expense of the monitoring equipment they've set up to keep track of him, that's got to make people have second thoughts too.
Well, it's so beyond 1984. He's wearing a satellite bracelet that it covers. It will set off alarms if he leaves the areas of his commitment, which are technically Monterey County, where Soledad is, and Santa Clara County, one of the reasons they selected Soledad is he will come up about 90 miles to San Jose in Santa Clara County, one of the next counties up, to get his treatment here. He will be driven up here by his caseworker. And they actually program into this satellite, this global positioning device, all the areas where kids will congregate in those two counties, schools, libraries, shopping centers, daycare centers. And if he goes near any of the centers, which he's not allowed to under the conditions of his release, it sets off an alarm. But it raises the question to me, Neil, whether someday we'll have a situation where, you know, people will have little homing devices on their children, and if a sex offender goes near them, they'll have a device that will set off an alarm, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, the day is coming.
Alan Gathright, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Alan Gathright is a staff writer for the San Francisco Chronicle newspaper, and he was with us from his office in San Jose. Joining us now from her home in Madison, Wisconsin, is Anna Salter. She's the author of several books, including Predators, Pedophiles, Rapists, and Other Sex Offenders, Who Are They, How They Operate, and How We Can Protect Ourselves and Our Children. And it's good of you to join us on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Is there a cure for the kind of pedophilia, the sexual predatory attacks of someone like Mr. DeVries?
No, there's no cure, but some people can control their behavior, and it looks like treatment can definitely reduce the incidence of molestation, but it can't eliminate it entirely.
As I understand, the rates of recidivism are about 20% without treatment and about 10% or maybe a little lower with.
Well, no, I wouldn't quite say that. In the first 4 or 5 years, about 13% of sex offenders are caught reoffending. The long-term rates are much, much higher. Out-of-home offenders, child molesters, it's about 50% over 25 years, and it's about 39% for rapists. So short-term rates are promising. Long-term rates are very worrisome.
Is there any agreement on the cause?
No agreement at all. We used to think it's because they were molested as children themselves, but there have now been at least 3 studies which have shown if you polygraph them and ask them if they were molested as children, about half the numbers say they were molested that say they were molested without the polygraph. And, of course, the flip side of that is we have 38 million molested people in this country, adults who were molested as children. And that's more people than voted for Walter Mondale in 1984. The vast majority of them never molest anybody.
What's the best possible scenario for these guys after they've done their time and gotten their treatment and then are released? Is what's happening with Mr. DeVries a model in your mind?
I don't know if it's a model because I'm not sure it's supportable in terms of the expense to have huge numbers of people on that kind of supervision. But it's certainly true that he is being very, very closely monitored. It's hard to think of anything else they could do to keep him from reoffending.
Let's get a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And Christine joins us from Minnetonka in Minnesota.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, being that child molestation is such a devastating crime, is there any legislation out there that would make these crimes sentencing parole or life without parole so that this isn't even an issue anymore where sex offenders would go? And do you know of any, and does anybody ever talk about that?
Anna Salter?
Oh, I don't know of any, and you better hope they don't pass any, because about 20% of our inmates are now sex offenders. We ran the numbers in Alabama at one point, and if you kept all of them for the rest of their lifetimes, you would have been building a new prison every year for the next 20 years minimum. And it would the cost of incarceration, we'd all be making a choice between keeping sex offenders in prison and sending our kids to college. The numbers are just so great. I don't think that's something the society can even begin to afford.
Christine, thanks very much. We have an email question from Nancy Brune in Lawrence, Kansas. As long as they're being extremely monitored, I would not feel uncomfortable having a convicted child molester in my neighborhood. I feel that at least if you know the identity, you can take precautions. Think of all the molesters out there who haven't been caught yet, and you have no idea who they are. Given that, Anna Salter, what can parents do? You can't keep an eye on your kid every minute of every day.
Well, first of all, I want to say I think she's dead right. I would not be worried about this offender in my neighborhood either. What I'm worried about are the coaches, teachers, priests, psychologists, just folks who run activity groups for kids who aren't caught. Every time I interview an offender, it turns out they've operated for many, many, many years without getting caught. And I've had offenders admit to as many as 1,250 different molestations. So it's the people we don't know about are the ones we really need to fear. What I talk about in my book on this is that it's just human nature to fear the wrong things. We're all afraid of the abductors, and they are terrifying. But the truth is that they're so rare, our children run a greater risk crossing the street. It's less than a 1 in a million possibility your child will ever run into an abductor. What isn't rare at all are the other guys, the doctors, priests, teachers, et cetera, who molest kids. And what I say to parents is we have to face the fact that when you put your child in a group activity with someone out of the family who's running it, that is actually a high-risk situation. It's certainly true that most of the people who run these activities are not pedophiles, but the chance that one day your son or daughter will run into one, that's not a small probability. That's a likelihood. I supervise these things. I go to my kids' sports practices. If a coach wants my child for an overnight trip, they get me too. I don't trust people who are likable and respected in the community. I've interviewed too many offenders who are likable and respected.
So the only advice is diligence.
Well, what I'm saying is we need to deflect this and not give people the opportunity to molest kids. And we need to trust deflection over a detection. You really cannot tell who's a child molester. They can be extremely likable. They can be charming. And we're all tempted to believe that likability equals trustworthiness. The truth is it really doesn't. We need to avoid high-risk people who spend all their social time with children and don't appear to have adult social or sexual interests. And we need to supervise situations with our kids, group activities. And
more after a break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing life after prison for convicted child molesters. Anna Salter is with us from Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison. You're invited to join the discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN@npr.org. And let's get a caller involved. Derek's with us from his car in Kalamazoo, Michigan.
How you doing?
Okay.
Good. I was basically calling to see, I had told a lady earlier, people in mobs, when they snitch people out, they went to, home security places to keep those people safe. And what if people that are convicted for, child molestation, they go, they serve their time, and they, build super communities for these people to go to so they don't have to worry about focusing on one person at a time and spending all this money. Instead, they could have a place for them to go, and it'd be easier to monitor all these people at one time.
Anna Salter?
Yes.
Well, I think a lot of correctional programs would like that. The problem is if there's anything that makes the community more nervous than one sex offender, it's a whole group of sex offenders. It's very, very difficult to find any landlord anywhere who will sell you or rent you a house that's going to be full of sex offenders. It can work, but it's a much harder sell even than the sole sex offender is.
Derek, thanks for the call. I'm sorry, did you have a follow-up?
No, that's about it.
Okay, thanks very much. We did find one landlord who is willing to rent to sex offenders. Joining us now from her office at the New Washington Apartments in Spokane, Washington, is Linda Wolf-DeWidgen, and good of you to join us.
Hi, this is Linda Wolf-DeWidgen.
Yes, you own and operate an apartment complex in downtown Spokane, and all of the residents there, as I understand it, are convicted sex offenders.
Well, not quite all. About 40 to 45 are sex offenders, either still on supervision or off supervision.
How did that arrangement happen?
I opened the building. I'm a recovering alcoholic, and I opened up the building to kind of service the alcohol and drug recovery people. And they proved to be most difficult because a lot of people, it's hard to stop drinking and drugging, and I took my first sex offender that wandered in from the mission, and he seemed like a nice enough guy, and I found out he was on supervision, and I thought, well, wow, that'd be pretty good because he's UA'd and polygraphed, and he's under a little bit of restriction, so he might turn out to be a good tenant. And as I took him in, more people heard about that I would be willing to take a chance, and I became more involved working with the Department of Corrections, and their partnership turned out to be favorable to help supervise my tenants. And I realized the need that when they're released from prison, they needed a little structure in their building because my building's alcohol and drug free, and I have cameras, and we have sign in, sign out, and I just progressed, and I became more involved with Department of Corrections, going to risk management meetings. And
Do you get any help from the state in terms of finances?
No, I get no help from the state financially. I rent my rooms for $240 a month, which includes cable, toilet paper, and a bed and dresser, and all utilities, and they pay that themselves. When they first release from prison, I do get a little higher monies from the Department of Corrections to house the high-risk offenders.
Now, your building, as I understand it, is in downtown Spokane. Do you have neighbors? And if you do, what do they think about it?
Well, I'm in a real good location for the type of clientele that I do house because there's no schools or daycare centers real close. There's an espresso stand across the street and a tavern and a motel that, you know, has weekly rates. So my location is probably very apropos for who I do house. I do not get any active resistance from my neighbors for my clientele.
Do they keep each other in line?
I believe they do. I a lot of them have been through sex treatment while they were incarcerated. Most of them are still highly programmed within the Department of Corrections. They go to MRT and victim awareness, and sex therapy with the various sexual therapy counselors. And I even have a DLC satellite office in the building that helps keep an eye on things, and it's a very good deterrent. I think also that when they converse with each other, they don't want the boat rocked where they're living at. It's hard for them to find placement that is an approved address by the Department of Corrections. They know that I can only take a limited amount of people. They're happy to be here, and they don't want to mess it up. And some of them, I do believe, have true remorse for their crimes, and with the therapy that they've gotten, that they do not want to reoffend.
I understand you have grandchildren.
Yes, I do.
Do you let them visit?
No, I won't let them come in the building. I will not allow any minors, but I wouldn't want someone looking at my grandchildren and going to their own room and having deviant thoughts. I just don't think it's a safe environment for children.
Linda Wolf-DeWidgen, thanks very much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Oh, you're welcome.
Linda Wolf-DeWidgen is the owner and operator of the New Washington Apartments in Spokane, Washington. She spoke to us from her office there. And Anna Salter, I have to ask, this arrangement seems to be working.
It can work. The only thing I would say is, in addition to sex offenders monitoring each other, it's really important to have staff involvement or correctional involvement. You wouldn't just want to trust them to monitor each other.
Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's get a call from John, who's in Sanford, North Carolina.
Yes, I was just wondering if there's any kind of correlation between repeat offenders and the castration, either chemical or surgical.
Well, we don't have a lot of modern studies on that. As you can imagine, in this day and time, you can't simply take a random sample, castrate part of them and not the other ones, and then look at recidivism rates. So the only research we have on this is European studies in the early part of the century. The truth is, it really did seem to work. The recidivism rates were very, very, very low for castrated offenders. Now, those aren't great scientific studies. They were done in the early part of the century. But that's about it for what we've got. And it did seem to be effective.
Couldn't you take the data in which you do have of those which have been and have not been and correlate it with if they've been imprisoned or recharged?
Well, they did that in the early part of the century, but these days we have very few people who are surgically castrated. So we don't have the kind of samples you would need to do that now.
It's not illegal for the government to surgically castrate somebody, is it?
Oh, I don't think the government can do it. If there's anything that's going to be considered inhumane, cruel, and unusual punishment, it's going to be surgical castration. I don't even think the people who wish we could have it really think it would survive some kind of legal challenge. Most of the cases that we have are the rare individual like the one in California who volunteered for surgical castration.
And not only volunteered, I understand his own family paid for it.
Right. I don't think the government would even be willing to pay for it.
Well, John, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
Let's get another caller. And this is Bob, who's in his car in Cleveland, Ohio.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
The question I have is, I doubt this is an issue that's exclusive to our country, and I was wondering if your guests had any information on how other countries are dealing with this issue.
Well, we know more about the Western countries, of course, than we do Far Eastern countries, and there's been research in all of the European countries. It looks like it simply exists everywhere. Child molestation is pretty clearly a problem worldwide. The Western countries, Canada, England, and the U.S., have really pioneered the new treatments, much more so even than other European countries. And the treatments that are most effective appear to have been developed in Canada and the United States particularly.
And which ones would you say those are?
Cognitive developmental treatment. It turns out that if you try to do some kind of psychotherapy or insight-oriented treatment with sex offenders, you end up with a lot of sex offenders with insight. But they do keep reoffending, so that doesn't tend to work. But group treatment that is cognitive behavioral, and what I mean by that, you look at the pattern of offending, the triggers, the thoughts, the feelings, the actions that lead up to it. And then you learn to recognize those and intervene early and go on a different track. That's the only kind of treatment that's been shown by the research to be effective.
Bob?
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. And let's go now to Dan, and Dan is in Beaverton, Oregon.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to reiterate a point that Ms. Salter made about you need to concentrate more on protecting your children rather than somebody being newly released. In Oregon, through request of information, you can get a list of sex offenders in your zip code. And in my zip code, there's actually 38 registered sex offenders.
Isn't this a result of, various states passed it, but Megan's Law, I think it's known as?
It might be something to do with that. I'm not sure actually how long the law has been in effect.
Anna Salter, maybe you can help us out.
Well, actually, it has everything to do with that. All 50 states now have some variation of Megan's Law, and Megan's Law began in 1994 with the rape and murder of a little girl. I'm trying to pull this up.
I believe it was in New Jersey.
Yes, a little girl in New Jersey. Since then, all the states have passed laws allowing people to find out who the sex offenders are in their communities. The truth is we've been releasing sex offenders forever, and we release large numbers of them from prisons all over the country every month. No one just realized how many sex offenders were out there until they started getting notified about them.
Dan, as you saw those figures, did that disturb you at all?
No, actually, I'm a physician, and so I was kind of aware of it. I was actually using it myself to try and educate my neighbors, because in Oregon there had been a brouhaha about a sexual offender being released, and so I was trying to pass the information on to people that wasn't necessarily the only person out there.
Thanks very much, Dan. Appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
Okay. Let's go now to Mike, and Mike's in his car in Laramie, Wyoming.
I guess the only question I was wondering about is, the way things are right now, with no place to hide, wouldn't this be a deterrent to keep maybe the people that are on the fence that aren't quite child molesters yet, I don't really know how to put it, but wouldn't that maybe keep them saying, boy, if I do something bad like this, I have no place to go, so maybe they won't do it? And that's what I was just kind of wondering. I don't think you want to make it too easy.
Deterrent value, Anna Salter?
Yeah, I hope you're right. Of course, we all hope you're right. The problem is, it looks like sex offenders get away with it for so long. Abel, one of the researchers, estimated at one point that the chance of actually getting caught for any particular sex offense was about 3%. It looks like what reinforces these guys is they try something, they don't get caught for it. By the time they are caught, the particular offender in California admitted to molesting 50 kids. I would say that's on the low side. From the research I've seen, the average offender who molests male children molests an average of 150. The ones who molest female molest an average of 20. So most of them just go on for so many years without getting caught that they think getting caught is something that happens to somebody else.
And then what I was wondering, though, I mean, if it would say, hey, I've got this little island sanctuary where I can go, and I guess it's just kind of reverse thing, thinking, well, okay, if I get caught, at least there's some place I can go. And I'm just kind of, troubled with that type of thinking, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, I think what upsets offenders much more is when they get caught. They're not usually thinking about when they'll get out of prison. It's the fact of going to prison and all of their neighbors finding out they're a sex offender and losing their job and often losing their house and all that. That's the real deterrent, to the extent that they think about these things. But I really don't think most of them are considering, well, what happens on the other end 8 years or 10 years later when I emerge from prison.
Mike, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're speaking with Anna Salter, the author of Predators and Pedophiles, a book of advice on what to do about sexual predators, and where you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We have another call. Let's go to Joe, who's with us from Kalamazoo in Michigan.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My call.
Sure.
I'm wondering if it's ever been tried to relocate convicted pedophiles into retirement communities where basically there are no children as neighbors, and possibly giving the other residents a tax incentive or some kind of financial incentive to have a convicted pedophile as a neighbor.
Well, it's a thought, but I think you'd want to think long and hard. And one reason is because there's so much crossover. About 50% of rapists in one study admitted to molesting a child. A lot of child molesters also commit rape. So you would think long and hard before you put a sex offender around a very vulnerable group of adults who would be unlikely to be able to fend for themselves. The other thing to think about is just that, let's say you have a retirement community. How big is it? It's not going to last several blocks. Okay, how close is the nearest school? Until you try to place a sex offender, you don't realize how many schools, daycare centers, residential sections, et cetera. There basically is no place for these guys where they're not within a half a mile or a mile of children.
Well, Joe, thanks for the thought anyway.
Thank you.
Anna Salter, what we seem to be hearing from you is that there are no easy answers.
There aren't any easy answers to this, but I still say we're afraid of the wrong things. We're afraid of the known offenders who are the most heavily monitored and controlled. In reality, it's only less than 10%, usually, of sex offenders who are even referred for these civil commitment programs. The rest of them are simply released in the community, often with parole, but some max out and they're not even on parole. There's a lot of sex offenders out there, folks. Wisconsin is a rural state. We release 60 a month. And we're not even a high-density or a high-population state. And none of that counts the ones that we don't know about. And they're really, truly the ones we ought to fear.
As you look at treatment, obviously prevention is what's going to be on most parents' minds. We just have about a minute with you left. Could you reiterate what your best advice for parents?
Rethink high-risk situations. High-risk situations are situations in which somebody has access to your children. A number of youth workers who are child molesters is not small. Supervise more. Be involved in your children's lives. Understand that the least likely thing to happen to your child is to be abducted, but the chance your child will run into a smiling, friendly, likable sex offender who comes in the front door is not small.
Anna Salter, thanks very much for being with us today.
And thank you.
Anna Salter is a psychologist and an expert on sex offenders. She also writes mysteries. Her latest is Prison Blues, and she joined us on the phone from her home in Madison, Wisconsin. When we come back from a short break, it's all about California. Governor Gray Davis gets a new presidential advisor, and Arnold is joined by an investment wizard ratcheting up the stakes in the great recall rundown of 2003. You can call us on that if you're interested. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address, as always, is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.